Okay, Georgie Dinkov, Generative Energy, show number 100. And I'm going to put you on the spot, Georgie. What are some of your memories of the last 100? I know you weren't with me for every single one, but what are some of your good memories of the last 100 shows?
Oh, I mean, like, I guess when I was in the old office, still employed the old company, the police walked in and like, while we're doing the show.
Are you serious? Like, I have like no recollection.
With guns drawn. It wasn't because of me. There was a report of like a theft or something in the office, and they walk in with guns drawn, and they're like, I don't know, they pointed, but they kind of explained that I would stop and raise my hands, and I didn't. And I was kind of gesturing to them saying like, out, you know, I'm not the thief. Go and like, do your thing. And they were stunned. Later, I talked to them the next day, and it's like, dude, when the police walks in with their guns drawn, you stop whatever you're doing and you follow orders. I'm like, nah, I was busy, so you guys go and chase the thief if I'm not the thief.
Well, are you talking about the original? Because some people might not know that you and I did a podcast before the live stream. Is that what you're talking about?
Oh, yeah, back in like 2015, 2016. Got it.
Yeah. So that's when that police happened, right?
Yeah.
Okay, got it. What about the live stream?
The live stream, I see. Let me see. I don't know. I mean, I guess the first time we talked to Ray, that was probably like, because I've emailed him. I mean, I'm probably one of the people that have known about him the longest, but have sent him the fewest number of emails. Mm-hmm. I think the total number of emails sent is probably less than 20 mm-hmm. over, you know, since 2000 and I don't know, 12 mm-hmm. or 11. Mm-hmm. And you know, getting to interact with him first time, directly was pretty humbling. What else? Some of the more, I don't know, like the ones with, did we do one with Matt or not? Like we participated with,
who?
On another one with Matt. The keto god, the god of keto or whatever he goes by right now.
I don't even know who that is. That first, I remember being in Thailand and having to wake up at like 5 a.m. or something, maybe even earlier than that to get ready for, it was number 19, I think, the first time we had Rayon. I think.
Yeah.
And I remember almost passing out getting him on and stuff. And I remember being like, am I going to hit live or pass out? Like before we were doing it.
You should have just told me. We could have, done it another day. Well, actually that's not going to happen. Cause like, as long as you're in Thailand, it will always be a crazy hour, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Every single time we did it from Thailand, it was some absurd hour.
Yeah. Another one I remember is like you got almost stabbed with a knife in Mexico, like because of your stubborn refusal to wear a mask.
Oh yeah. That was I almost forgot about that. It was at the post office. I wasn't wearing a mask, and some guy that was on many medications like charged at me with a box cutter. Man, you know what? I wish.
What a pendejo! Was he like a Mexican or a gringo?
He was from Brazil or something. He was complete maniac. You know what? One's really the episode. I can't remember what number it was, but the deja vu, life after death one. I remember a lot of good stuff coming out of that entire episode of stuff that he had never necessarily covered before in detail. And I remember like reveling in like re-listening to it after it was done. And that,
did I tell you? Treby called me.
Oh yeah. Oh nice.
I mean, it was about I guess ordering talk of it, but we. You know, I called her back. She left two messages, and I'm like, I don't know of anybody else named Treby, so it's got to be her. But I called her back, and we spent 3 hours on the phone.
That's Treby, yeah.
Are we recording? Should I tell you what happened? Basically,
we are recording. Whatever you want.
I mean, basically, Ray died completely healthy. I don't know whether they did an autopsy or whatnot, but like the rumors that, he had a cardiovascular disease or organ failure or whatnot, she said none of that is true. Like basically, like even the doctors were like, "Well, we're supposed to say he died of old age, but in reality, we don't know." Basically, what caused? I mean, obviously, it was stroke, right? But they don't know what caused the stroke. He had no blockage, like nothing that will justify it. The only thing that I guess that my guess is that if you're at that age, if you get exposed to like a lot of smoke, toxic smoke and stuff like that, like the coughing and everything, that strain can sometimes cause it. But according to the doctors, he was in top-notch health.
That was something I think that a lot of people didn't know about, that he was dealing with the fire smoke from the Oregon fires during that time.
Yeah.
I know this makes me sound like an apologist or something, but like, I think if any, have we talked about this before? Like if anybody's kind of fact, like trying to figure out what contributed to his death, I think they have to add in the most stressful last 3 years of anybody's life, you know? Like,
yeah. Trevi kind of like confirmed what you and I have been talking about. He basically was disgusted with the world. He was a much, much bigger optimist before the pandemic than he was during and than he was after. Yeah. The fact that 2/3 of the population, I think somebody asked him, like, what do you think about this whole thing? He's like, well, 2/3 of the people basically do whatever the government tells them. And even if it means staring apart, they're like their fellow men, the people right next to them.
Yeah.
So for a humanist like Ray, I guess that was pretty crushing.
Yeah. A broken heart has to be factored into that
whole exactly thing. That would have been my other guess, a combination of basically, you know, feeling like you're getting exposed to toxic smoke, you realize that vast majority of people garbage or at least so severely hypometabolic that, you know, you can't really expect them to resist the system in the state, and then basically at some point, I mean, he probably thought like, okay, why am I doing all this? You know, Trevi said he probably realized everything that he could have done, he already did, right? So he just checked out. You know, there's not much else that can be done.
Yeah, crazy. To be honest, I haven't been thinking about it very much. But man, every single time I listen to Trevi's call, I like shed a tear. It's like every single time.
But she's really nice. Yeah. You know, we're... I mean, I don't know if she told, but like he's been guiding her for years with some health problems. We just did a hair analysis for steroids for her. And she's fine, except that she's really, really cranking on the progesterone on the DHEA. But like she said she had estrogen issues or cortisol issues, but these came back, no, fine. Right. So maybe some good news. I'm about to send her the results, so. Another 3-hour phone call.
Dude, amazing. Yeah, I was lucky enough to talk to her multiple times in maybe before, but way before the pandemic, maybe like 2014 or 15. But yeah, she offered up tons of, she had a funny story about Ray, and because I think they live kind of close in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And Ray was telling her about how important it was to eat liver. And she was like, okay, well, Ray, where do you get your liver? And he's like, find your own source. Like
that. Like, she told her to find her own source.
Something, it wasn't like mead, but I think Ray had some setup where like the butcher would call him when the liver came in so it wouldn't sit around and like develop those toxic compounds.
Oh, an endotoxin or whatever.
Yeah. Or like there are those like specific meat proteins that toxic.
Oh yeah, the cadaverin, the putrescine, just the names. they're kind of pretty revealing. Yeah.
And so I hope I'm not misremembering the story, but I'm pretty sure that was accurate. But we both laughed because it was so funny. Like, find your own.
Stop bugging me about it. You're a grown adult.
Anyway,
yeah. So ask about Catherine. She's like, you know, she's doing okay considering what happened, and I asked if we can be of any help. She said she's going to talk to her. That was what I think. Talked to her maybe like 2-3 weeks ago. She said she'll talk to Catherine, and then if there's anything that both of them think that we can or would be nice to do, then she'll let me know.
Great. Yeah, I would just love to connect with Catherine in general, but obviously for it to be on her watch, you know,
on her terms.
Okay. So we're going to talk about some articles today. We're going to do an update on Idea Labs and crazy. I mean, we probably should have got to 100 a while ago. I think we've been, I speak for myself, I've been a little bit lazy with all the, like, we're building a gigantic fence right now. It's over 5 acres and it is like absolutely insane.
Damn.
And
who is we?
Me.
Right. And basically you do not dare tell the mamacita to do some digging.
No, she won't be digging any fence posts anytime soon. But it makes me feel so good because the dogs would occasionally just run off the property. And at least when they were smaller, I was like, man, they might not come back, you know, or somebody could pick them up. Like, they're really good looking dogs. And so if I just saw it, I mean, I wouldn't steal somebody's dogs, but somebody else might, you know. So
but now they're grown up. How would somebody pick them up, they'll bite and bark, right?
Not really. Like, though, they have like a lot of bark, and then when they get to the person, they'll be real nice to them. So it's okay. They're not very mean dogs whatsoever. But anyways, also, I think I've complained on the show 1,000 times about other dogs just kind of entering the property. And so anybody that has like land knows what I'm about to say, but there is like an endless amount of things to do. Like you could like work and trick out a piece of land forever. You know, like I'm already thinking about like 4 other projects that I need to do of where I need to put security cameras and stuff. And it's just like, man, there's like an endless amount of things to do to, especially if the land is big, like you can't monitor it all. So you have to strategically put cameras in different places. And
I remember when my grandfather was like just a year or two before he died, like we took him to the city to go see some doctors, and because it was obvious he's not in good health, and he just couldn't stand it. You know, even back then when, you know, it was still during communism, and, you know, the city was not that big. It wasn't really industrialized. I mean, it was industrialized, but it's not nearly as what it is, as crazy as it is right now. He could barely stay like for 10 days, and, you know, he wanted to go back. And I said, like, why? He's like, you guys have nothing to do here. You know, he's like, I got this farm. And he's like, even if I had nothing but the land, he's like, I could be busy all day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I kind of got a sense of it when I was, because I grew up on the farm in the summers, at least spend my summers there. But, you know, these people, like, they're attached to the land, and he basically one day, he's like, I'm like, so what do you think is a time well spent? He's like, I don't know what a time well spent is, but I'll tell you that any time spent not working the land is wasted.
Seems right to me, yeah. Crazy, man. So that's been occupying a lot of my time. And, okay, we'll talk about Idea Labs. We'll talk about coaching. And, okay. Georgie, I just chose 5 articles that were the most popular on your Twitter. And moving
from the latest 8 or something?
Yeah, like so, yeah, okay. I mean, we can talk about any of them, but this was the most popular one. Do you want to chat about this one first? The aspirin may replicate the benefits of fasting while avoiding its risks.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of talk about autophagy, I guess, in all circles, including medical and the dietary scene. And of course, the proponents of autophagy are saying you cannot get into autophagy unless you fast. That's not true. First of all, second of all, you got to be careful with autophagy. Autophagy is now known, actually, because I think I kind of mentioned it too on Paul Saladino's show as well, is that it's known to be a strong tumor promoter. And it kind of depends on the tumor type and stage. But basically, there's a large number of tumors, and I'll go on a limb and say the majority of them, where autophagy is upregulated. And the reason we know it's contributing to the tumor growth is because there's several drugs that inhibit autophagy, and they're now in clinical trials for basically for treating the cancer. So they've already been proven to work in animal models, and now they're in human clinical trials. So I don't think autophagy is something you want to mess with. You know, just the whole thing of like one cell eating another. It just reminds me actually of what cancer cells do. If you remember that study, that cancer cells steal mitochondria from neighborhood cells around them. Well, that is a process that's very, very similar to autophagy. And in fact, it's probably like a cancer specific type of autophagy. Another study said, basically did a review of autophagy and, you know, promoting and inhibiting it, and said that most cases of heart failure, autophagy is upregulated. Now, somebody can say, well, of course, you have a lot of dead cells in the heart and they need to be cleaned up and whatnot. But again, once you do the intervention part, right, you form a hypothesis that autophagy is bad, it's contributing to the heart disease, so you try to inhibit it and see if there is a good result. There was. So autophagy on its own is probably not something you want to mess with, or at least trigger through fasting. Now, fasting is actually known to, while, you know, initially cause a slowdown of tumor growth, to actually make the tumors highly aggressive. So when they come back, like basically there's like a brief period of like a plateau in growth, not a decline. They never regress, almost never. And then basically after a period of about 2-3 weeks of hard fasting, then the tumors become very, very resistant to chemotherapy and radiation. Which is not surprising if we adhere to the hypothesis, which is now, of course, becoming more and more popular, that excessive fatty acid oxidation is driving tumor growth, not the glucose, which the tumor wastes. So the fasting, which is known to actually promote the tumor growth after several weeks, and of course, it does upregulate autophagy, and it does it quite strongly. It just gives me like a pause. So this study looked at aspirin and said, okay, so what does autophagy achieve? What does fasting actually achieve? And they never mentioned endotoxin, even though other studies have demonstrated that most of the longevity benefits of fasting you can do by basically keeping the gut sterile or giving the animals charcoal. I think Ray mentioned that on one of his articles. Some farmers noticed that if they give their pigs charcoal a couple of times a week, pigs live like 40, 50% longer. I don't know who keeps such old pigs. They usually slaughter it, right? But somebody did that experiment, and it's been replicated in rats and mice and whatnot, and not just charcoal, but with antibiotics. I think there's a study with TLR4 antagonists, which are drugs that block the endotoxin receptor, and all of them display, you know, lifespan extending effects. So basically the study said, okay, so fasting, inflammation, it reduces inflammation, but it doesn't address how, right? So does autophagy. Okay, so fasting lowers blood glucose initially. Well, so does fasting, but initially. Fasting lowers blood glucose. And basically the when you're getting to the hold on a second. Yeah, fasting lowers blood glucose, but it's only initially. So after you get to after the first, let's say 48 to 72 hours, then you actually get a rise in blood glucose because of the cortisol and the adrenaline. So fasting, what does it also do? Oh, it's known to actually stimulate the clearance of estrogen from the bloodstream, right? What else does it do? Fasting is known to lower the levels of oxidized and the bad cholesterol, LDL, but LDL by itself is not bad. It's known to lower the amount of oxidized cholesterol in the blood. And fasting is basically known to initially promote, but it's only in the first 24 to 72 hours, to promote the synthesis of T4 in the thyroid gland, and also, probably because of the increased clearance of estrogen, to also promote the conversion of T4 into T3 in the liver. But all of these are short-term effects. So that's what the study looked at and said, well, aspirin can do all of these things. And the master regulator, basically, that gets turned on by fasting is the AMPK. Adenosine monophosphate kinase, and basically most of the proponents of fasting low carb diets are saying we're targeting AMPK, and it's kind of like it has an inverse relationship with another pathway called mTOR, mammalian target of rapamycin. Ray mentioned a couple of times saying that one of the reasons to avoid the inflammatory amino acids, not only because the inflammatory, but because they activate the mTOR. That's methionine, the cysteine and tryptophan, and also some of the branch chain amino acids as well. So the study says, okay, so we want to inhibit mTOR and we want to upregulate AMPK, and fasting does this. But guess what? Aspirin does all of these things as well. Everything that I mentioned so far, aspirin is known to do. So they said basically, you can achieve the exact same effects with aspirin. And then they looked at the dosage, and the dosage was the equivalent of, I think, for a human, basically 2 tablets of aspirin daily. And considering all the other benefits that aspirin does, especially the cancer prevention, the depression, the mental health improvement, the reduction in inflammation, the improvement in digestion, the improvement in the steroid balance, because the metabolite of aspirin, the salicylic acid, is actually an inhibitor of cortisol synthesis, the inhibition of excess activation of aromatase, the lowering of free fatty acids, and it's an anti-lipolytic molecule. Basically, the inhibition of excessive fatty acid oxidation, aspirin does that too, works very similarly to the drug meldonium, in fact, in about the same doses. So if you get 4 grams of meldonium, which is really, really high pharmacological dose, but if you look at animal studies, that's how much they're kind of using for really bad cases of heart disease, or basically that most of the heart is already fibrotic. You achieve about the same inhibition of fatty acid oxidation by 4 grams of meldonium and 4 grams of aspirin. Now, all these trials are in animals. So I don't think 4 grams of meldonium have been tried on humans. Aspirin and couples oxidative phosphorylation, basically it will increase the thermogenesis. And I think it increases, basically the conversion of T4 into T3, which depends to a large degree on the core temperature. So if anything that warms you up, basically, it's going to also promote further increased metabolism by increasing the conversion of T4 into T3. And all of these effects are aspirin has. Oh, it lowers glutamate in the brain. It lowers extracellular serotonin. It increases the activity of tyrosine hydroxylase, so it will increase dopamine as well. You come up with a condition and you type aspirin in that condition in PubMed, you're going to get multiple studies, kids saying that, you know, aspirin does all of these things. And of course, lifespan, right? There was that study that posted back in, I think, 2015. It was willow bark extract, but that is basically the surrogate for aspirin in nature. The only difference is that aspirin is acetylated. And that in yeast model, I guess that's the cheapest model they could find. It extended lifespan by 400%. I don't know of any other molecule that has achieved something in any model that has achieved such an increase in lifespan. So the study is saying that, you know, maybe, you know, we should look at aspirin as it meets all the criteria for caloric restriction mimetic, CRM. So if that's the case, then, you know, there's no point to torture us. And we could just take the two tablets of aspirin. And by the way, even though the study didn't mention it, I've looked at the studies. I think Ray mentioned it too. Is like, you actually don't have to take it every day. There's a study out there that looked at like how rarely can you take aspirin and still get most of the same benefit for cancer prevention. And I think the answer was the minimum that was needed was twice a month. Oh. Yeah, so you could do that. And I think somebody asked me, like, how often do you take aspirin? He's like, well, whenever I remember, which happens to be like on average once a week.
Classic, classic Ray answer.
Yeah, exactly. Whenever I feel like it and remember it. Yeah.
And also, I don't want to commit to anything either.
Yeah, why would you want to? Yeah.
The funniest thing is I feel like autophagy has like the best marketing team ever, especially in the low carb space. Because the number of people that have told me, well, what about autophagy? Like that is like you could fast and so much bad stuff could happen. Like you mentioned the release of fatty acids, the activation of the hypothalamus pituitary, so much bad stuff is happening. And how somebody could be like, well, autophagy is happening though. It's like,
I have an explanation of why is it happening. I just remember I didn't post the study yet, but actually it addresses that. Mm. It showed that the same metabolic, it's beautiful study because it ties aging, cancer, and virtually all other diseases, and shows that you get DNA damage when the oxidative phosphorylation is not working, simply because the process of cell division and copying is actually also dependent on energy. It's so simple and intuitive, but nobody has said this publicly until the study. And the study is saying that if you force the cells to divide in a suboptimal energetic environment, you will get bad stuff happening, and actually you will get basically defective cells. Mm. Well, of course, autophagy or autophagy will be upregulated when you're fasting, because you're in the absence of sufficient energy, you're going to be copying, you'll be creating all of these bad malformed cells, and autophagy is there to pick that stuff up and basically get rid of it. But it doesn't mean that it's a good process, right? What you want is autophagy to be there to pick up the cells that are basically, because it's inevitable, some cells will get copied incorrectly or during the cell division. Some of the information will get copied incorrectly. So, but you want that in the background of high metabolism, and in that case, you probably wouldn't need as much of an autophagy because the rate of defective cells being created will be much lower. So when you're fasting, yeah, sure, autophagy picks up steam and starts working over in an overdrive, but that's not necessarily a good sign. And I think that it's kind of like the testimony to that is that autophagy is also upregulated in about 60 to 70% of the cancers that we know, and in heart failure. So, you know, it's there to help you, but you probably don't want to be promoting it, right?
I think in one of Ray's articles, he referenced at least two papers, one showing that T3 increased autophagy, and then the other was lanosterol. And so
fructose increases this. I don't know the fasting crowd, because when I did a podcast with the Strong Sisters, they asked me about autophagy, and I said I'm wary of it because I've seen their studies on cancer, and they're saying well can't you get autophagy like without fasting? And I did a little research, and it looks like all of these sugars that Ray has been mentioning, especially trehalose, fructose, and glucose, which means sucrose, they actually increase autophagy, but not to the level that you've seen in cancer, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, you can get autophagy without torturing yourself to death, and if you still feel like you can use a little extra. Take tablets of aspirin, or like one tablet of aspirin. I mean, anything.
If a person,
you don't have to suffer, to get more benefit. No pain, nor gain has some truth to it. But more pain, more gain is it invariably wrong in my experience.
Yeah, it seems like not something to ever worry about. Like your body's just going to handle it.
Right. I mean, it's you want to worry to the, I mean, I would worry in the sense of like, I don't want to promote it, right? Yeah, it's a process that's there. It's very ancient evolutionary. And I'm always wary of these ancient things because we came from like basically the slime, mm-hmm. this shapeless slime that used mostly glycolysis. So anytime you activate an ancient mechanism like parathyroid hormone, serotonin, right, prolactin, these are not good things to upregulate.
Yeah.
And autophagy seems to be, one of the earliest processes that we evolved with.
There was a certain doctor, I won't name names, but I remember maybe like 5 years ago, he was like, he posted an article, maybe I've mentioned this, I often repeat myself on here, but he posted a study on lower blood sugar increasing growth hormone on Twitter. And he was like, this is what those like petards will never understand, that lower blood sugar equals higher growth hormone. And
it was which promotes cancer, by the way.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, the Ray Pete people tend to think that growth hormone is bad stuff because everything that comes from the pituitary in excess is bad stuff, basically.
Oh, well, I mean, I'll say good doc, keep injecting it. You win the Darwin Award.
Anyways, we've talked about that subject many times. Okay, let's jump to the next one, which is, this one was very popular. Century-long metabolic decline, not less exercise, and or more eating causes the obesity epidemic.
This is, I think, a follow-up on several posts that I've done over the years. One of them said that as early, I think it's like the 2014 or 15, said, what the hell is going on? Like, it's not just the people that are getting fat, but the wild animals that live in the vicinity of people are also getting fat. So it's definitely not like, because, I mean, you can't tell me that suddenly the deers or badgers or like, or I don't know, or bears decided to become sedentary and watch TV. They don't. They're just wild animals. They live the same as they've always lived. So, and then they looked at the physical activity of humans, and they found out that the younger generation actually have the highest amount of physical activity per person that has ever been measured since the records have been kept. I mean, there's some records from like centuries ago, but they're not considered very reliable. But over the last 100 years, the millennials and the Gen Z especially are basically the most physically active generation. So they're definitely moving more. Okay, so let's see it. So the only thing that remains, like, okay, are they basically eating more and compensating? No, they're actually consuming the least amount of calories, moving, you know, more than any other generation, and still obesity skyrocketing to the point where the World Health Organization, which I hope they collapse in flames and burn hill, but they estimate that by 2050, I think 50% of the world population will be obese. And they lump everything together. So which means if you separate them into developing countries, two-thirds of the U.S. population will be obese by 2050. Half will be diabetic. So what the hell is going on? So obviously it is not the calories. Something else. Well, I mean, it depends where you get them from, right? So calorie, turns out calorie is not a calorie. But even if it was a calorie, we're not eating more calories. We are expending more calories. So what could be it? And they said, well, the study looked at it and said, they're quoting another study, which I think is what I posted after the first one, the fat wild animals. It said that the decline in temperature, which is a surrogate for basically thyroid activity, temperatures have been declining since basically over 100 years. Well, our core temperature is now, I think, 2 degrees on average lower than what it was around the turn of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't look at basically metabolic rates. But this study did look at metabolic rates and said that basically over the last 3 decades, we've seen double-digit declines, basically in the lower double digits of males. And initially they said there was no such decline in females, but when they look at the data and controlled for several other variables, then they found the same thing for females as well. That's 3 decades. Let's say 40 to 15% decline of the metabolic rate over 3 decades. Assume the same thing has been going on for 3 decades and another 3 decades, so you get to a century. So multiply 15 by 3, you get 40. So we basically have half the metabolic rate of what people had at the turn of the century. I think it's a reasonable estimate. And if you look at the old commercials from the 1950s, like, have you seen these housewife commercials, what you feed your kids, sons?
Yeah, yeah.
My God, they were eating probably on the average of 4,000 to 5,000 calories daily, most of which were from saturated fat and hardcore sugar. Mm. They were drinking soda like crazy. And these people were not fat, and they were not moving. They were moving probably, they had 50% lower physical activity than we do. And the testosterone levels were higher, right? Well, that's the other thing. So basically this, I don't know if we discussed this in previous shows, but basically testosterone levels have been declining and IQ scores have been declining. So while testosterone levels are mostly applicable to males and be measured, I don't know if the same thing has been done for females, because they don't know what's the fertility hormone for females. For males, they know it's testosterone. But if you look at IQ scores, which are tracked across both genders, and basically you see the so-called Flynn effect and then the reversal of the Flynn effect. The Flynn effect is basically the IQ scores have been increasing throughout the 20th century, all the way up to the 1970s, when there was a, you know, kind of like a plateau, and they've been declining ever, I think, like since the mid 80s. So basically now, if you look, since the scale of the IQ scores is logarithmic, if you look at the level now, we're basically at the level of what used to be in, I don't know, maybe 1960. But I don't know. I wasn't around in 1960s, but it definitely feels like we're being ruled by morons. And the amount of morons, the rate of the percentage of moronic individuals in the population seems to be increasing. So all of these, basically, since IQ score is one of the best surrogates for thyroid function, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that supports the study. And basically, the study says that it's not the calories. Again, reiterates that it's not the amount of calories we consume. We consume less calories than previous generations. And it's definitely not the lack of physical activity. We do move more than almost any other generation for which there's a reliable record of. So the only thing that remains is basically it's the declining metabolic rate, which has drastically declined. I mean, 50% lower. So imagine how much smarter the people at the turn of the century was, which actually, again, another anecdotal piece of evidence, a circumstantial piece of evidence, is that all of the major scientific discoveries that all of our environment is currently based on were made in the pretty much the first 20 years of the 20th century. After that, I guess, was just stagnation. Oh, we talked about stagnation of science, right? But all of these things, since science is done by people, all of these things can be tracked down to basically lower metabolic rate, which ultimately means lower intelligence. Wasn't it Bernard Barnes who said the difference between a retard and Einstein is like 3 grains of thyroid?
He said it exactly like that, too.
Okay.
That was the verbatim quote, exactly. Yeah, and then, I mean, if you couple that with what Ray said about the 1989 acceleration of the vaccines, like, it's totally screwed, you know? It's like foobarred and never going back. That's pretty wild, but not unexpected whatsoever. I think we did talk about this, but somebody posted a photo of the soda aisle in like, maybe it was the early 90s or late 80s, and it's just all glass, you know? And so that's just one toxic element of the culture that, or the food
system.
Another
person on the forum posted that basically glyphosate, also known as Roundup, basically is even nano gram per liter concentrations, which is that's basically parts per billion. Mm-hmm. That's what's allowed for most heavy metals, including uranium. I mean, the food supply and the FDA allow uranium and plutonium and many other metals in your food supply if they're in basically less than, I don't know, one part per billion, right? Glyphosate, which is found in most commercial food products, especially in non-organic produce, but also in other food products, because it's so difficult to completely get rid of when you're making food products from the vegetables that are being processed with glyphosate, the pesticide. So in nanogram, I think 4 nanograms per liter was sufficient to basically make the animals morbidly obese. And that thing is everywhere. Several studies have been done. It's an endocrine disruptor, right? Its main activity is actually blocking the glycine receptor in the body. So maybe one way is to just consume more gelatin, but I'm sure it has other mechanisms of action that we're not aware of. So there's all of these poisons that are around us that are ultimately contributing to a lower metabolic rate. That's what it comes down to. if you injure the body, even mechanically, that still leads to basically lower thyroid function and activation of the HPA.
I'm going to go a little off script here because I just remembered that this question keeps popping up in like every single one of my calls. But then we can talk about Idealabs. But what is your take on the mRNA in food? Like that seems to be something that is, if it's not already happening, they're talking about it in the news frequently. And so
they have to encapsulate it in something that would allow to, first of all, it to be stable at room temperature, and second, to survive basically the acidity of the stomach. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that all of these vaccines that were basically, one of the reasons why they couldn't vaccinate the entire world is that parts of the world have no stable supply of electricity, and you mm-hmm. couldn't deliver these deeply frozen vaccines there, because like as soon as they, while still frozen, if the temperature basically rises by about 10 degrees while still deeply frozen, the mRNA starts to disintegrate. I don't know. I think it's troubling, and I don't know if they already have the technology. I'm afraid they do. But what I'm saying is that the current mRNA, the way it's used in vaccines, cannot just directly go into the food and then they feed it to us. Now, since there is horizontal gene transfer, and it's known, genes have been known to be transferred from plants to mammals and the other way around, it is distinctly possible if there is a large amount of this mRNA in the food, that at some point, basically, it will be reversed. Some portion of it will survive and basically get absorbed and will get reverse transcriptized. I would say that's probably more nefarious than the vaccine, because the vaccine contains the intact thing, but it's a one-time injection, right? Well, no, not anymore. They want boosters. But assume it's happening rarely. With the food, if you're eating 3-4 times a day, and if every time you eat, there's basically a large amount of these mRNA particles in the food, I would say that's probably more dangerous than the vaccine itself, because you're basically drastically increasing the exposure to mRNA and the chance that that intact mRNA will get into your bloodstream and then basically will wreak its havoc through the inflammatory pathways, and also ultimately, God forbid, gets reverse transcriptized into DNA.
That's definitely worrying. I was thinking, because a lot of people are asking about it, I didn't think about the nano encapsulation part, because if you just had a COVID vaccine and you popped off the top and you drank it, that would be way less harmful than injecting it into your blood. But I guess you're like, I didn't think about the aspect of actually putting it in a nano encapsulated carrier, and then it could be very damaging.
Yeah, I think the oral vaccines, they're very fearful for that reason, basically. Mm-hmm. Even if you're dealing with viral vaccines for the polio, I think there's a nasal polio vaccine. Mm-hmm. And I think the oral polio vaccine, it's not something, you ingest it, I guess, ultimately, but I think that the goal is basically to absorb through the mucosa mm-hmm. of the mouth, and that's how it works. Mm-hmm. To make something that's oral, and if you're dealing with these, fragile particles, but, for all the lethality and danger that viruses pose, they're surprisingly fragile. So they're not, maybe one reason why there's, very few viruses are basically, getting into your GI tract basically through the mouth. You can catch them, right? I mean, especially the hepatitis viruses. Actually, a lot of hepatitis are blood only. But, it's most of the viruses that you can catch have to use a different pathway. They don't go through your gastrointestinal tract and then infect you. And the ones that do usually infect the gastrointestinal tract and stay there, like the enteroviruses. You'll be, there's a reason for that. It's just most of them cannot survive this pathway. So if they're going to be putting stuff in the food, I think they'll bank on just having, that much more particles of the mRNA in the food. So they're hoping that proportionally they're going to get enough of that mRNA inside of us, so it triggers that immune response.
Worrisome for sure. Okay, so on that note,
I'm more worried about them injecting the animals with it, yeah. Because basically, when you inject those animals, first of all, they trigger the inflammatory response in the animals. Not that it's not triggered now, because the animals are injected with other vaccines, but if you're eating, multiple studies have shown that if you're eating meat from animals that have been mistreated, but not in the way that PETA wants us to treat them. I mean, like, if they're infected or if they're given, like, basically if they're in poor health, the meat from these animals is basically not very good for health either. The rats that eat it develop, you know, conditions. And I think the reason is that because we can produce cortisone and estrogen everywhere. Wasn't it somebody asked, like, what happens if an alligator eats like a woman that's taking a birth control pill? And Ray said, like, well, he feels sorry for the alligator because of what all that estrogen is going to do. well, every animal that is under stress, you know, often injected with vaccines and whatnot, basically will have a high amounts of cortisone and estrogen in its tissues. And it's not something you want to ingest on a regular basis.
Okay. Good stuff. Thank you for clarifying that. I think that's what is happening. The animals, like, they're kind of announcing it now, which is obviously worrisome. I wouldn't be surprised if they had been doing that for a long time. And just
well, speaking of bad announcements, do you want to talk about the IMF thing? Or
well, I do want to talk about that. Let's maybe save that for the very end on the outro to leave people with the great news.
Yeah, to give them like nice sweet dreams.
Yeah.
Depress the hell out of them.
Tell us about ID Lovis, but first I have to ask you. I've at least two or three people are waiting for Tyrol Max to come in stock. So do you have any update on that?
All of the large vendors, something's happening, in my opinion, regulatorily, because all of our suppliers, including some who are out of the country, basically are out. Now, I don't think they're out. They're just not selling it. Or maybe they're waiting for price increase. Mm-hmm. If they're waiting for inflation to kick in again. I don't know what the deal is, but none of the large vendors that we used to have, especially the ones that had the organic powder, all of them are out. So something's going on. I don't know what it is. So, I mean, I'll keep working on it. But you know, for now there's really no solution. And if large vendors of the rank of Sigma Aldrich, not that we're using them cause they don't sell thyroid powder, but large chemical vendors that have basically presence in every country in the world and have been selling this for decades, suddenly are completely out and they don't even have an ETA. You know, we're regular customers of them, we call them, we ask them, and the response that we get is pretty dry. It's basically saying, like, can't tell you anything. It's out. That's it. Usually they'll give you like, well, you know, expected to ship, I don't know, 3 months in the future. They don't have an ETA now. Oh. It's just, it's really strange. And it's been happening. I mean, it started happening during the pandemic. So I thought it's related to supply chain issues, but you know, assuming that stuff is still going on well in China and other places, I've contacted Chinese vendors as well. They don't have it, or at least they don't want to sell it anymore to somebody in the States.
Would they purposefully not sell it because of inflation, because people are locked into contracts for a certain price?
Of course. I mean, basically, if they feel like there's going to be an uptick in inflation, why would they sell it to you now? Oh. Especially things that are, I've noticed that, and I think Ray mentioned it too, like the raw ingredients for most dietary supplements and the cosmetics and whatnot and the research chemicals, the prices are through the roof. And that inflation, I don't think is. I have not seen. I know Mr. Jerome is doing his best to lower inflation, but I have not seen any dent in the inflation of these supplies and raw materials.
Yeah.
So whatever inflation he's tackling, it's not the one that's affecting the supplement industry, and the chemical industry.
My girlfriend yesterday told me that she went to Costco and they told her she could only buy two milks, two boxes, and that scared the hell out of me, because not only do I drink that, but I feed it to like every animal. I like 32 animals now. And so that's...
So there is a Costco in Mexico?
Yeah, they have.
Really?
Yeah. We've talked about it before.
I don't remember you saying there's a Costco in Mexico.
Yeah. It's in Celaya, which is like the most dangerous place ever.
Wow. And of course, they probably have like a counter where the local cartel is showing their wares. And they sell by the case.
It's like when you go to Celaya, it's like you understand immediately why somebody would be tempted to go into a cartel. It's like the most unstimulating, boring, like, environment. Everything is gray. And it's, when we went there, I was like, man, this place is so boring. And it looks just like very,
like a mining town or something.
It's just like dulling the senses of like, and we were in like the ostensibly the nice part of the area. But anyways, okay, what else is going on at Idea Labs? Anything else to note?
Let me see. I guess we're getting closer to doing the neurotransmitters in hair and nails. I think that would be pretty nice, because we should be able to test the GABA, the serotonin, the dopamine, the precursors to both of these. Basically the tryptophan and the L-tyrosine, as well as the metabolic byproducts. So in one test, we should be able to cover stuff that's basically, usually if you go to the doctors and say you want to test dopamine and serotonin, it's hard. The sample needs to be frozen. Oftentimes the test doesn't work because the freezing wasn't like done soon enough or well enough and whatnot. It's an expensive test, etc. The other option is the doctor will basically do like a 24-hour serotonin metabolite excretion, urine excretion panel, right? Measurement, same thing for dopamine. There's dopamine metabolites and the homovanillic acid, and then there's like the 5-hydroxyindoleacetic acid for serotonin. So that's the test, but it doesn't really tell you what the internal turnover and basically what the level of dopamine serotonin is, because it only shows you how well we excrete them. So this thing, if we can measure all of these things simultaneously in hair or nails, should give a pretty good indication. There's a ton of studies I didn't know, but it makes sense for these studies to be there. The ratio of serotonin to dopamine is predictive for many diseases. The ratio of GABA to glutamate, I forgot to mention glutamate as well. The ratio, I think, of like the serotonin metabolites and the dopamine metabolites, the ratio of histidine to histamine, which is another thing we should be able to measure as well. So kind of like just a different way of looking at health. Basically, if somebody's struggling with chronic inflammatory condition or an allergy, we should be able to see that through the histamine, histidine, and the serotonin, because we know they're involved. So we should be able to, add even more evidence to the crumbling theory. I'm sorry, against the crumbling theory of serotonin is low in depression, right? They never talk about dopamine, but I think like the several studies show that dopamine is low in depression. Well, if dopamine is low, serotonin is usually high, unless you're taking that ancient drug called reserpine, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. It depletes all of the monoamines. It depletes everything, basically, and that's why it kind of puts you to sleep. But if your dopamine is low on a blood test or a urine test, chances are your serotonin is high because they're inversely related. Anyways, I hope to be able to get some decent evidence, and we're going to start publishing papers, so you're going to see a lot of G. Dinkoff, on several journals. I already have eight. I should send you the studies. I have maybe like 8 or 9 published, but they're not with that serious group that I have right now. They used to be more like a one-off thing with until I found the right people and started working with them. We should have some nice studies, basically. Some nice new molecules that we're synthesizing that are derivatives of the beta lapachon. We'll try to publish a study on those. We did a study on the anti-estrogenic effects of the naphthoquinones, of which vitamin K is a representative. And both vitamin K3 and K2 are strongly anti-estrogenic on a yeast assay. They basically sell these like yeast kits, and you can test whether it's something androgenic, estrogenic, or anti-androgenic or anti-estrogenic. It looks like, and a lot of people have commented on the forum, I think you've seen it through the years, that taking vitamin K like made their face wider and their jaws seem stronger and like more square. And that's, you expect either an androgenic or an estrogenic chemical to do that in males. And now we have evidence that vitamin K2 and K4 specifically, and also K3, menadione, are strongly anti-estrogenic. The test on androgenicity was like kind of like half and half. There is activity, but I don't think, at least according to that test, it will require much higher concentrations than what you expect to be achieved in humans. I still think that we can show androgenicity. There's the fact that vitamin K increased testosterone levels in the rats, and also, there's another study which showed that it has a anabolic effect on muscles. I mean, these are basically androgenic and anti-cortisolic effects. So I will see if there's like a yeast kit for glucocorticoid agonism, antagonism. So we should be able to do it as well. But, we kind of have direct evidence now that the vitamin K family is anti-estrogenic directly, and not through the inhibition of aromatase. We did test them for that. They were inactive. So something is doing, I guess they're acting directly at the receptor. There is a study showing that vitamin K3 is a pure estrogen receptor antagonist, kind of like that drug fulvestrant, but fulvestrant is toxic. And actually, if you look at the molecule, it's just estrogen, estradiol, with a slight change on position 6, position 7. While vitamin K3 is a pure estrogen receptor antagonist at a concentration of 1 micromole per liter, which is pretty low. You can achieve that with about 3 to 4 milligrams single dose. But the MK4, which the only difference between the two is that MK4 has a longer lipophilic side chain, It should be even stronger because it gets to the cell in higher concentrations and has a longer half-life. And we kind of confirmed that in the yeast assay, showing that vitamin KMK4 was a stronger estrogen antagonist than K3.
Incredible. Hey, you can't hear my fan going through my microphone, can you? Okay, good. Okay. I do coaching on patreon.com/JennyRowdy, and I recently retired the email portion of this. So I used to answer emails, but I have just replaced it with new 45-minute each week group coaching. We'll kind of see how this goes. And if a lot of people take advantage of it, we'll do it all the time. And if nobody comes, we'll delete it. So anyways, it's $100 for two 45-minute calls. And then I'll be doing a 45-minute group calls every week. Maybe that
will blame me about the email retirement, man. Yeah. That thing is just a pain in the neck.
I couldn't keep up with it. I mean, it got to the point where I'd have like 10 calls on Sunday and Monday. So 10 on Sunday, 10 on Monday. And then on Tuesday, I would have off. And that day, I would be answering emails the whole day.
So you don't have off. No, you just have a different type of work.
So I was like, man, why am I so tired? I was like, oh, I just continuously work. I don't.
Yeah, there's something about answering emails that's really draining. I prefer to have discussions on Zoom or whatnot.
100%.
You know, maybe it's the personal contact that's more uplifting. But email, I think it's because it's purely verbal, right?
Yes.
You're dealing only with symbols. It's very abstract. It's context-free. And it's also like every time you answer, it's kind of just like a one-off answer, right? If somebody else can be helped by the same or similar information, you forget, right? I mean, with all these people being emailed and you have to redo it every single time somebody has a very similar question.
Yeah, I all the admiration in the world. It helps, you know, when you know all the answers.
But when I don't.
But when somebody's asking you something that you have to go research, like, I mean, answering a single email could take 45 minutes and you have 80 emails.
And it's draining. Yeah. It's not just the answer. It's just draining because you have to do all this mental, like you have to go and learn new stuff,
yeah,
right? Combining with the old stuff you know, and then come up with a legitimate answer.
Yeah. It's not the, like you said, I've actually had, I wouldn't say them bad email interactions, but maybe the person and I were talking past each other. And then we would finally jump on a Zoom call and it would be completely different. Like,
I think the face-to-face thing it cannot be underestimated.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sorry, overestimated.
Absolutely huge. This was before I had more specific views on like kind of the toxicity of internet communication, but that was like something that stood out in my mind pretty early on, that like this person seems a little bit off on through email or on the internet, but talking to them is they're completely normal,
completely different.
And so,
didn't Rachel say something about it? That there's something about in-personal communication that kind of like tones things down and like puts things into perspective and prevents like really extreme behavior.
I'm sure.
Well, not all bets are off when things are online and it's just you and like a wall of text.
Well, there's like a performative aspect to it. It's like people say like, so all forums have their problem, you know, but like you'll be communicating and then somebody will post just to make a joke, you know? And so that's just like, I don't know, internet communication just is problematic in general. I'm not even saying specifically the bioenergetic forums or groups or whatever. Anybody who spent time on Facebook knows this, like that you can have a normal conversation with somebody and then your toxic uncle or something will ruin it immediately.
we'll jump in.
But you know what? One other off topic thing is, do you have any thoughts on Elon Musk, the Twitter thing? Who did not know that this was going to happen? I mean, it's almost like a setup or something. They got people to feel real comfortable on the platform and they even pay for a blue check mark certification. And now it's by some WEF woman, it was pro vaccine, pro mask. I mean, it's completely outrageous.
I always thought like, why would the deep state have to censor these people on Twitter? Let them come out. They say, keep your friends close, your enemies closer. Mm-hmm. If you want to see these white right-wing extremists, these white supremacists, all of the anti-government people, just let them bitch on Twitter. You monitor, you record, you have evidence against them, right? It's basically the perfect setup it's like the January 6th, the J6, and you can do it for years and collect all this evidence, decide how to monitor and decide which one of the most dangerous. Why would you want to shut them down? They're going to move either offline Or it's, okay, if they go to another platform. Oh, the other thing is like they try to move to another platform, and then the provider started shutting those platforms down. I'm like, no, that's the, if you really want to take them down, let them like speak online. You're forcing them offline, and when they're offline, there's no control over them. They, you don't know what they're up to, right? You can't track them all. So I don't know. So maybe Elon has called his buddies at Deep State. He's like, guys, you're dumb. Twitter is a spy engine. Let me run it. And then this way you will know a lot more about the enemies than if you keep forcing them offline. I don't know if that's what happened,
well,
but
well, that's assuming that
I got censored on Twitter. And I, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I don't know what was it because they never told me, but basically my access to the API, because I have this like app that is stored on the blog that every time I post an article, it takes that, takes a snippet, and post it on Twitter, right? It's all done automatically. The moment I click post on the blog, this thing posts to Twitter. So I got an email saying like, oh, your account, your access to the API has been suspended due to violation of the terms of services, right? And then basically I try to appeal it. They denied it, appeal it again. And then basically they said, kind of like, well, it's not really anything specific, but we've done a review. And then we found like several, and I've been very careful not to talk about things related to the vaccines and COVID and whatnot. I mean, I've talked about COVID, but in the sense of like, hey, look, it's a metabolic disease, that the same villains are present as well. Again, like, you know, PUFA, cortisol, etc. I've never been even close to what some of the people that got completely blocked from Twitter said on Twitter, but I got censored. That was after Elon took over and said, hey, I'm a free speech absolutist. So I got a retroactive ban in a sense, right? After Elon took over. So I thought, so, you know, maybe he fired actually, because, you know, he claimed he fired, what, 80% of the Twitter staff? Maybe the 20% that were left were he couldn't fire because they're government employees. They're the censorship apparatus, and it's still there. It's still in full swing. You say something that really rocks the boat and see how quickly you get kicked out of Twitter.
Yeah, I watch a lot less of his material these days, but James Corbett had a good background on him, and there's no way he's some organic genius. Like
you don't get to his level. No, he's not a genius at all, but you don't get to his level of richness without kind of like being rubbing shoulders with a deep state. Yeah. You may be a bit more independent minded, right? But ultimately, you're operating under the umbrella.
He had said something that the ADL didn't like, and they sent him a tweet. They're like, Elon, delete this tweet, and he immediately deleted it. So, and then the other thing was, you know, people were posting like demographic crime or whatever, and he was like, interesting. Like, are you the dumbest motherfucker on the planet? Like, you're feigning like that you've never heard this stuff before. I mean, how dumb is he? Like, I just, and also, like the SpaceX stuff, I'm a moon space, we're both are, space denier. Like there's no way that he's sending rockets to space or whatever and not knowing the real story, you know? And he has to be part of something. Like he, again, I hate to be so...
Most of his so-called fortune is basically due to the zero interest rate, the ZIRP policy, and the printing of money. He's received a lot of money from the government in terms of subsidies. I don't even remember how he suddenly became famous. I know he was one of the original, he was part of the PayPal mafia, right? Yeah. So it was him, Peter Thiel, and Pierre Omidyar, I think it's like that. So he was one of the people that kind of like, you know, got rich off of PayPal. But I don't know exactly what he did. Why did he suddenly become this basically?
Grimes.
He what?
He dated a very like kind of niche music person named Grimes. That was
right. So that's what made him famous.
I think it definitely catapulted him into kind of the public zeitgeist. Like,
he's like this weird genius that basically nobody understands.
Yeah, but the James Corbett stuff was talking about setting him up as like that, and so it goes back to these really old clips where they're trying to set him up as this like a Tony Stark type of thinker person. Uh-huh. And so, just nothing.
The modern Nikola Tesla, right?
Yeah. It's just, exactly. And so, wasn't there a funny Ray reply as somebody was like, what do you think about Elon's ideas?
And there's the potential to destroy life on Earth.
Yeah, Ray's like, they'd be really good to destroy all life on Earth. And also, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but Elon had like, lock in where it wasn't lockstep with every kind of major agenda. Like he was very pro vaccine. He was very pro like UBI. He was very pro digital identification. And so, man, if you're some Ben Shapiro, Jordan Peterson conservative, you're probably fooled by him, but...
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Again, you don't get to become a billionaire without playing ball, you know, with deep state or for deep state. It's just, they're going to find some other way to, you know, to get away. The fact that he's being promoted, what was the thing? Like, enemy never gives you free publicity, right? Why would the press always write about him? You know, I mean, he gets kind of like a bad rep. I don't even go to Twitter, to Reddit anymore, but sometimes I check like the politics section. And then whenever they have an article, they used to be very, very negative about him before I threw this stuff. And after he took over Twitter, they try to like paint him as this like right wing nut job conservative. But those posts have kind of disappeared. And now people are kind of cheering for him. It's like, oh, you see, he's not that bad. He put this WEF person in charge, which means Ellen is starting to see the light. Yeah. So everything will go back to normal. I was like, it never changed. Yeah. What do we go back to normal? They're still censoring left and right stuff that's, that they don't like. I think, wasn't Robert Malone? Who was the doctor who basically like one of the most vocals, most outspoken people against COVID and the mRNA vaccines? He got banned from Twitter, and Ellen basically, like, this guy asked to be reinstated, and Ellen said no.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm skeptical of those guys, too. But, yeah, McCullough or Malone or whatever.
Oh, yeah, any of those. I mean, again, like, nobody gives you, you know, in an environment like this, if you're getting free publicity, chances are either you're directly playing for the deep state team or you're doing something that benefits them.
Yeah.
Otherwise, nobody will mention anything about you. Yeah. But we've seen already, like, basically there's so many different stories the UMU. Maybe I should talk about that. The IMF. So
got it.
We've been talking about central bank digital currencies. Yeah. That's been the conspiracy theory over the last 3 years.
That's we can talk about that right now. That's fine.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Oh, should I? Yeah. So we've been worried that countries will release their own like central bank digital currencies. But it turns out the situation is much, much worse. Without any mentioning in the popular press, except on the IMF website, which, of course, is not the popular press, IMF, during their annual meeting, which happened here in Washington, D.C., maybe like three or four weeks ago in the beginning of April, they quietly announced that they've released, it's not just planning, it's not thinking about implementing, it's already implemented, and now they're making it public, the Universal Monetary Unit, UMU. It is 100% digital currency. It has all of these features that will be discussed, that people will be able to control spending. They will have it's programmable. Currently does not have these things enabled, but it does have them as features. So if you want it, if the people want to enable them, they can. So all of these things, like the tracking carbon credits, banning specific purchases instantaneously, in real time, with holding taxes without even having to file any form, kind of controlling. Did you type Universal Monetary Unit or something?
Is this not it?
Let me see. Go to Google and type IMF Universal Monetary Unit. And I think the only hits that I was getting was basically the IMF page. Oh, I think that's the one. Yep, that's the one. Yeah. Look at the page. It's like even the title doesn't even say it. Let me see the international. Yeah, there we go.
I don't know why this page's format is so wacky.
That's the link. And DCMA, which is an organization within the IMF, they reveal the universal. The title says it all. They reveal basically they announced the Universal Monetary Unit. So it's at the IMF level, and then they're saying like individual central banks will decide when and how to link up to that. So it won't even be at the state level. It basically complete. It's not just the state tracking, which is already bad enough. You'll be complete tracking at the global level, and all the central bank at the local level will do is basically just hook up the monetary system through that, and then IMF will basically have full visibility. So it is being global order, new world global order from the very beginning. And I think at this point, most of the states, at least the ones that are subservient to the IMF, they don't really exist. They only accept on paper. They don't have any sovereignty. If this is happening and basically the IMF is saying, you don't need to worry about CBDC at the local level. We already have you covered. Just hook up to ours and basically we're going to deal with, you can still keep your own currency, right? But it's just a name. Underneath is the same unit. We're going to set up an exchange rate with that, you know, with that UMU. So it'll be like, you'll be dealing with UMUs, but it'll be fractional depending on what's the exchange rate, you know, of your local currency to the price of UMU that we'll set.
This is interesting. Banks can use UMU to securely connect to SWIFT codes, but that would be too slow for digital currencies. So a lot of people think they're going to use XRP.
There's no need. Look, it's already there. I mean, it's already announced. So now the only thing that remains is that, you know, there'll be a little bit of a battle. They'll pretend to fight back. And, you know, we'll see how many countries will basically link up to that IMF system. If you look at the response to the pandemic and the lockdowns and everything and the vaccines, what, 100 and some odd countries out of the, what, 150 or 180 in the world, they complied like this. Probably the same thing will happen with the UMU.
Yeah, we'll have to see. Another sister article to this is those four banks collapsing being like way bigger than the 2008, but just at the mainstream media.
Nobody's talking about that. Yeah. Try to find me something that's in the mainstream press that even mentions the fact that already the bailouts, because these are bailouts. Let's call it, they're quiet bailouts. They're backdoor bailouts. They've already basically cost the U.S. taxpayer three times more than all the bailouts that happened at the 2008 Great Financial Crisis.
And I hope this isn't misinfo, but I think they were all absolved by J.P. Morgan or something like that. They just let some banks fail. Like, other banks were also insolvent, but they didn't let them like publicly fail or something like that.
You mean back in 2008?
No, like this
round. I don't think any bank has failed. The ones that have been absorbed, that's the whole point of the absorption. They don't want any depositors to freak out and basically start run on the entire bank system. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of forcing. Remember, was it like a Merrill Lynch got bought for $1 by Bank of America? Mm-hmm. That's the kind of deal, because these banks are technically, you know, insolvent. They can get bought for like, you know, $1. Like, it's just really a token transaction. Mm-hmm. And then since most other banks, actually even JPM, will not buy them, they're buying them with credit from the government, with money, with interest-free money from the government.
So, but the point of consolidating these smaller banks is just to make to do what?
To transfer to CBDC much, 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 much more easily, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, if you have six banks, you know, and you have no other alternative, it's basically an oligopoly. It's a cartel. It's already a cartel, but at least you have these like thousands of credit, small credit unions and small banks and regional banks. And once these are gone and absorbed into the big bank system, if tomorrow all these six banks say, hey, we're doing CBDC, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. Where are you going to go? It's much, much more easy to, much easier to basically, you know, these six banks, which are, by the way, calling the shots behind the scenes anyways, because they are the largest shareholders of the regional Federal Reserve banks. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the ones that want this, and that's how they're going to get it. Also, they're eliminating competition. They're going to acquire all of these assets for, like, basically, not only they're not paying anything, they're getting government money to buy something. Like, I just don't get it. And I don't think they actually have to return that money. Mm-hmm. It's just the government saying, hey, I'm going to print out another $30 billion and go and buy, like, I don't know, Silicon Valley Bank. Mm-hmm. Of course, they're going to buy it. It costs them nothing. But they are acquiring these assets and the clients and everything that comes with it. So yeah, ultimately, I think all of this is one step after another is preparation for CBDC. Mm-hmm. Look, there is no other way. Okay. There is no viable economic activity left in the West. All that's left is financing. I read the Zero Hedge website very often, and they have this common theme there in the comments saying, like, you cannot taper off a Ponzi scheme. Mm-hmm. There's just no way to do it. So whether CBDC or World War come first, we'll see. But I stand by my original statement that we'll get one or the other. I think they will attempt the CBDCs first. And then if that doesn't work out, then basically it's war, some kind of war. They'll trigger a major war, potentially even World War. Or if things start going really bad in Ukraine, then we may get like a, you know, false flag attack. And then they're going to enter the war anyways, even before the CBDCs, because then institute martial law, and then CBDCs or not, it doesn't matter. They still control everything about you.
Yeah. Hold on a second. Hey guys, thank you so much. We're not doing these live just because it's a lot easier not to do that. So appreciate you guys watching. Give this a like on Telegram or Substack. Please subscribe to the Substack. It is dannyrowdy.substack.com. And I'm really trying to put all the content on here quickly. And yeah, just being a plethora of content that you can easily subscribe to. And then the
Telegram. You're not worried about Substack? You don't think they'll start censoring at some point?
No, I'm worried about everything, man. Telegram, I don't trust either. I don't trust any of these things.
Why did you sour up on Bitcoin? I was thinking about asking.
I wasn't going to announce that. I was going to probably say it the next time. My feelings of this are very complex, and so I don't even know if I could articulate them.
Such is love, my friend. Yeah. Have you ever had feelings towards a woman that were not complex?
Well, what's funny is I think I was like more making a case for it the last time we talked. So again, nothing has changed in the sense that like The Economist really does post 24/7 negative stuff about it. Okay, so here's a way to approach it. The last 3 years of my life have been like crazy, but they've also been like the most fulfilling years of my life. And those have all been from moving away from the internet. And mm-hmm. So me like having some interest in Bitcoin seems completely like contradictory to like any level of like goodness in my life.
Yeah.
And I told you I did buy some silver, and mm-hmm. having that in my hand was like, whoa, this is like really cool. And so anyways, one of the large like gold sites was like, you can pay in cryptocurrency. So I was like, it was like an adrenaline.
I think it's a good deal. Give them shit and I can buy some good gold, some good bullion.
But to broader context for this, like I held during the 70,000 Bitcoin thing. And so again, somebody can clip this and throw it in my face if Bitcoin goes to like $1 million or something. But I guess I was just acting in accordance with what I've learned over the last 3 years, you know?
Yeah.
And again, if I'm doing that, I can't really go wrong. You know, I'm acting on my instincts, and my instinct was like, get out of this. And
I'll give you two practical reasons not to deal with cryptos. Number one, it all depends on the internet.
I'm still messing with cryptocurrencies. That's not,
well, it's fine, not, but I'm saying like to not bank on it long in the long run.
Yeah.
Number one, it relies on the internet. And we're moving towards full spectrum 24/7 surveillance and enforcement on the internet. Did you see the Restrict Act that's about to get passed in the US?
I maybe heard of it, but tell us.
Forget it. If they label you whatever they want to label you, it doesn't have to be an extremist. You're done. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you touch a computer or if you get on the internet without their permission, they'll throw you in federal prison. Mm-hmm. End of story. So the internet is moving towards, you know, and let alone allow you to like move currency and money from across borders and whatnot, they immediately label you a supporter of foreign terrorism or like you're a Chinese spy, you name it. And they don't have to prove it. Okay. They'll invoke the state secrecy doctrine. And if you're big enough fish, or if they want to make an example out of you, they'll do it. There's nothing that can be done about it. Number one. Number two, the enforcements that are coming basically, so over the last 2 years, we've moved from leave Bitcoin alone, it's the wild, wild west, you know, things will sort themselves out, to the point where basically like now everybody's clamoring for regulation, which really means, and I kind of suspected they'll do this, they're saying, well, the technology is really cool, and that's public domain, so we're going to take this technology, but we don't really like, and I'm already hearing politicians say this directly, because I thought originally that LBD, I was surprised that I didn't hear this argument earlier. They're saying like, you don't want to have a competing currency in your country. Like, you look at what the Chinese are doing. They ban all of this stuff outright, right? And they're saying like, well, you know, we can't really ban it. It's kind of like freedom of speech in the States, but these are just, it's not really laws. They're just guidelines. And then I saw what they did in the merger of Credit Suisse with UBS. You know, that this deal that the government forced, that basically by law, and the Swiss apparently care about law. It turns out that they don't. It's just the same charade there as it is here and everywhere else in the world. By law, this deal that merged UBS with Credit Suisse had to be approved by the shareholder boards, by the shareholders actually of both banks by law. Okay. Mm-hmm. You can't have a legal merger of these entities unless both shareholders say, approve and say, yeah, that's a good deal. We agree to it. The government moved in and said, we're not going to hold any of these shareholder meetings. The merger is done. Go take a cold shower, and that's the end of it. So if that can happen, I mean, like they can overnight, they can declare Bitcoin or any other currency, basically a counterfeit currency that's competing with the legitimate currency, and overnight you become basically a criminal. So and finally, of course, like the internet in terms of it's just being around. Okay, you know, they're already preparing. I mean, I think you saw the, what is it? What was that agenda that they were basically simulating a internet going down?
Oh, a cyber polygon.
Yeah, cyber polygon. So that was basically, that was kind of like, that was the next plan. I don't know if it will happen, but they've already done the pandemic with the viruses, right? They tried the UFOs, that didn't work. So this, they're kind of running out of things to do other than world war and go, the internet going down, just to see how the population will react to it. It will certainly be troubling and you know, and it will freak people out, right? That's exactly what they want. And will make people clamor for more control. So, you know, you don't want assets that are sitting somewhere out there in the cloud, even if they're these nebulous, like abstract assets, because, you know, if things go down and things are going to decentralize as kind of like what in the direction we're moving, at some point you may be holding just worthless numbers that nobody, you will not be able to communicate to anybody else or exchange for anything else like of actual value. So yeah, fiat currency, it depends on the internet. And it's being, you know, heavily regulated against by everybody and almost outright being banned. China already did that, right? It just doesn't sound to me like something you want to deal with. I mean, it makes you think that, you know, that's probably something that the government doesn't want and it's undermining it. But at the end of the day, it runs on the internet and they control the internet. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, for any Bitcoin maxi listening, the Luke Smith has a series of videos about Monero being what people think Bitcoin is. It, like, people think Bitcoin is private or it offers some anonymity, which it doesn't at all. And it's actually like worse than a credit card transaction because you're making it public.
It's a public ledger.
Yeah.
Once your identity is tied, I mean, is tied to you, and you can do it by analyzing the traffic. In fact, they have an entire department and several government agencies doing exactly that. I know this as being a government contractor, and actually it's not even classified. They just don't talk about it. It's for official use only.
Yeah.
And but basically Bitcoin is fully known. Yeah. You don't have to be a member of Coinbase. You don't have to be a member of Binance. Even if you have your own private wallet at home, you're running on your laptop, because this is your laptop, and Windows, most people running Windows, tracks you. And then of course, then there's the ads tracking you and identifying you. The government knows who owns and how much of Bitcoin, and you know, there's very little you can do about it. Monero is a bit of a different story, but I suspect it's a honeypot as well. The IRS, every year they announce they're going to pay, I think it used to be $1 million, it's like up to $5 million of somebody who can crack Monero. Mm. And they claim that, you know, 5 years in a row, nobody has shown up.
Yeah.
So they kind of like setting the stage for like, oh, let's, of course, they're saying, oh, people think Monero is great, let's go to Monero. But, you know, we don't know who created Monero or like whether there's like some kind of a backdoor built into it. I don't think the Monero source code has actually undergone any solid review. In the absence of that.
Are you positive that's true? I thought there was a team of known people. That's actually a ding against Monero, that it is controlled by a group of people and could change. So the inventor is
could change, but I think the nobody has actually analyzed, has done an audit of the source code.
Got it.
So you don't know. I mean, yes, we know who the people who wrote it and who created it are, but nobody has analyzed the code for any backdoors. And we know the NSA and many other government agencies are putting backdoors in open source code, but they usually caught when there's an audit. Basically, if you have like millions of eyes looking at this code, chances are somebody will spot something nefarious. I don't think a public audit has been done on the Monero code.
Got it. Last thing about Bitcoin is, this was Luke Smith's point, but he was basically like, the first layer of Bitcoin is so bad. So like a lot of the maxis are like, well, that's what Lightning solves, the second layer. And it's like, and his basic point was like, if your first layer is completely dysfunctional and you have to add something else to it, like then you're just trying to plug the holes in the sinking boat, basically.
I call it the pharma protocol. We give you a drug, it gives you side effects, then we give you drugs for the side effects.
Yeah.
But again, those cause more side effects, and that's like layers upon layers of crap.
Yeah. Again, I wouldn't tell anybody to sell their Bitcoin. It was basically an impulsive decision on my part.
No, I also keep a little bit of Bitcoin, but it's mostly for transactions with people that are abroad. If you want to send money to Bulgaria, I mean, as you know, the fees are not low. Somebody can use something used to be called TransferWise. Now it's called Wise.
Yeah, yeah, I use it all.
But because it's dealing with a regular banking system, first of all, it's slow. Second of all, it's subject to all kinds of restrictions. Like if they can flag a transaction as suspicious, even if it's for the same person, from the same person, for the exact same amount, the exact same time of the month, like every day of the month and whatnot. No, randomly flag it. We're going to block it for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Call us, provide all this documentation. And it's like, it's not like they're just asking for a copy of your ID, which they already have.
Yeah.
Give me like these 10 different pages of stuff that, you know, I have to spend time. So Bitcoin is actually probably really good for like interpersonal transactions that are not for very large amounts. Yeah. For that, yes. But that kind of, it's not going to resolve the issue of full control over your financial life, which, you know, or your wealth or like the product of your labor. You know, that is moving towards full control of it so that you work as much as they tell you on whatever they tell you and whatever you make, if anything, basically they tell you how to spend when, and how quickly.
And there's very a big possibility that there could be a huge pump before the dump. So, again, we'll somebody can clip this and send it to me if there is a gigantic pump, but I don't care, so don't send it to me.
Well, I mean, there may be a pump, but again, none of the superpowers will allow a competing currency.
Oh yeah, no,
that they do not control.
Yeah,
no. If it survives in any shape or form, it will be for the masses, but for very small amounts, and you know, or it will be outright banned, or it will be absorbed into the coming, you know, CBDCs.
Yeah, well, that is the delusional aspect of some maxis. Like, there is a kind of a famous debate between Michael Saylor and this kind of pedo guy named Frank. And he says something like, Michael Saylor says something like, the U.S. will use Bitcoin as a currency. And it's like, dude, what are you smoking? That will never happen. And Frank, who is like probably like he's like associates with like Epstein and weird, that's why I call him pedo. Like he was like, Saylor, that will never happen. The elites will never let like Bitcoin become some standard currency in the future. And I think he was saying that because he knows.
or I mean, either way. Okay, so let's say they don't control. They'll find a way to basically like to put control over it.
Yeah.
Again, it's a public protocol. It runs on a public. It learns on a controllable infrastructure. So if you want Bitcoin to truly be independent, it needs its own protocol. But again, even if you're doing like they do these like peer to peer network protocols that basically phones discover each other and they don't depend on the internet, you still depend on a phone, right? Mm. This can get shut down remotely by the tower within a millisecond. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think just the whole point of moving away from digitization, it cannot really happen if you're going to be going to a digital currency, even if it's undermining the current system that we have. Just like Ray said, you know, the progressives, they're right of tearing down all of these bad like structures that have been going on for centuries, and they're very oppressive, but they go too far. And one thing I asked him and he couldn't answer once is that, like I said, Ray, you support these people, okay? So they're tearing down a lot of bad structures, but what are they proposing to replace them with? And he didn't answer. I don't have any idea. So destruction for destruction's sake, I think it's good only to a degree. You don't want to collapse. I mean, if you collapse everything, then we're starting from scratch, and basically that's the equivalent of World War. If you collapse every structure in society, you don't need nuclear war. I mean, we're gonna eat each other like the Batman. What? No, it was a Joker in the Batman set. So I don't know how much is too much. Okay, so at what point, you know, how do we decide that, you know, we've destroyed enough of the bad stuff and we stop and we start to rebuild? So far, I haven't seen any sign that the younger generations are willing to let go. I think they want everything torn down. And actually, they don't even, if you talk to some of the younger people, they don't have an idea of what comes next. They just want it gone, right? And if you try to explain things like, well, you know, you're not going to have anything to eat, there won't be electricity, forget about your phone. You know, people may meet you on the street and shoot you on a whim, you know, stuff like that. Like, nah, you're just old timer. Okay, boomer. I'm not a boomer, but yeah.
Yeah, man. Well said. Let's save these last three for next episode because we've been talking.
I'm going to have more. Okay, I'd like to. This perfect. Is like maybe one quarter of what I'm going to post, even
All right, perfect. Yeah. Okay, well, let's wrap this up. Where can, obviously, idealabsdc.com, twitter.com/heydit, any other...
I mean, heydit.me, the blog, got it, basically. Got it, but I think people know about it. Most people apparently do not read the blog. they comment on Twitter, and it's basically, they look at the title. If you like it, you know. Actually, the people that know me and that will be following us, I think they read the blog. The new followers on Twitter, the vast majority of them are just there to like pick a fight, you know, score a point, score a like.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I'm the Bulgarian wizard. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So DannyRoddy.substack.com, t.me/DannyRoddy. Those are the places I'm most active. We have an amazing listenership. Really appreciate you guys. We will try to do the next episode sooner than later. I apologize for the long wait. Thank you guys so much. Thank you, Georgi Dinkov. You make these shows worth doing. 100 episodes. Really appreciate you. And let's do 100 more. And we'll talk to you guys soon. Peace out.